In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives, amen. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. I've been pondering that this week and wondering, what does that really mean? That the message of the cross is foolishness. Somehow this foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and it's this proclamation about Christ crucified, which is a message of saying the anointed one is crucified, or the Messiah is crucified, and that somehow that's good news. What does it mean that that's good news? What does the cross mean for us today? I was thinking back to my childhood where I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and Denver sits at the mountains, just at the base of the mountains. And during the day, you can see the mountains arrayed there. It's like living in Vancouver where you can see the mountains. But at night, somebody had a piece of property up on top of one of those mountains or high up on the side of one of those mountains, and they constructed a big neon cross that must be several football fields big, because you can see it for 40 kilometers away. Like if you're out on the front plains, you know, 40, 50 kilometers away, you can see this white neon cross on the mountains. When I was a boy, and you know, you're riding around at night, and you know, it was actually really you know, you get excited if you see the cross. I got excited if I saw the cross. That, you know, my family was Christian, and you know, it was good to feel like there were other Christians in the world, or at least there was somebody else who was a Christian in the world, right? And I think I felt a sense of comfort about it. There was a sense of almost like, it was almost this sense of like, you know, God is there and God is watching over us, right? I think is kind of the feel. I don't know if I could have said it as a boy, but there was something of that as a boy. So this weekend I went down to Seattle to hear David White do a poetry reading. He's a poet, and so driving back on I-5 at night and through the Skagit Valley, and I come across, drive by this farm, and there's this white neon cross, right, in some farmer's field right by the highway, and it's probably 20 feet high, and you know, and it got me thinking, like what prompts you to put a neon cross in your farm field? And then I kept riding through, you know, the town there, and then I noticed there's a new white cross on top of the hill. I've never seen it before, but somebody else put a white cross on top of the hill. So there's lots of white crosses along the highway and neon as you're driving up there. And I'm like, what prompts you to put a white, what goes on for you? What are you thinking when you put a white cross there next to the highway, 20 feet high, and you're paying for it? What are you thinking, right? And what are you hoping to happen? And it, you know, it got me wondering, well, it's like, do you believe that this is a light that shines in the darkness? And so you're trying to shine this light for people who are lost in the darkness. Like it is a beacon that if you want to come and you need help, you can knock on this farmer's door, right? And if you're lost in the darkness, you can come and knock on this farmer's door and he's going to help you, right? Is that what's going on there? Where it's meant to help you navigate the highways you're going in the night, and this farmer wants you to know, though, there's, you know, it's lighting the way. You know, maybe he's just trying to say, hey, I'm a Christian and I want you to know, and broadcast it to the world, right? And maybe he's like, there are Christians in the world, and then everybody who drives by on I-5 who's a Christian can do the spiritual high five as they go by, right? But then there's the flip side of that, and if you're not a Christian, what does that say? And what's the intent if you're not a Christian? Like, is he trying to reach out to the Christians, or is he trying to reach out to the non-Christians? And what is he trying to say to the non-Christians? You better get with the program. Like, if you're not with the program, you better get with the program. Or there's good news, and I want you to know about it. But what does this cross actually signify? I realized that... I didn't know what his intent was, and if Paul is right about there is something foolish about this proclamation of a cross, do I even know the foolishness of that anymore? Have we so domesticated the cross that, I mean, I, you know, just kind of take it for granted. It's like we see crosses and, oh, it means you're a Christian, but really, what does that mean? Thinking about the ancient world, and if you were in the Mediterranean, anywhere in the Roman Empire during the time of Jesus, you would see crosses all the time, but they wouldn't be empty. There would be bloody, broken bodies on these crosses. Like, the Romans used crosses as a way of putting terror in people. When the Romans subjugated, took on, and overtook a nation, if there was any resistance to Roman authority or Roman power, they would take the individual and the resistors and those who are being rebellious, and they would put them on this cross, and they would put it by the highway so that you had to pass by it if you were traveling. And if you're traveling, I mean, and I was trying to conceive of that. This was something that people saw all the time because they were present. It just didn't happen with Jesus. It's happened all the time. So you're living with a daily experience of a body suffering on the road as you're walking by. Like, what is that like? I have never seen anybody tortured. I've never seen anybody intentionally put to death. And that makes me unique. Like, in the history of humankind, you know, we do public executions has been like a common thing in human history. The guillotine in France and, you know, hanging, you know, people dying by hanging in the South or North America, or people dying by shooting squads. And these were public. Like, you could go and see justice being carried out and watch somebody die as a result of the power of the state. We don't see that anymore. I mean, thank God that we don't see that anymore. I mean, I know you can go on YouTube and find videos by ISIS and other folks who are going to show you a beheading as their execution of justice, and you can watch somebody die, and I have never done that because I don't want to do that to my soul. I don't have to sit there and witness that. I mean, I don't know but what is that like for these people who are traveling on these roads to have to pass by these bodies that are suffering and in trauma, and I don't know what that does to you psychologically. I mean, it's terror-inducing. What's curious is, you know, these people who'd be traveling on these roads would be, many of them, if they're going into Jerusalem, are going there to the temple. And, in Jewish worship and in Jewish religious practice, if you want to honor God, if you want to worship God, you can do that with prayer. You can do that with reading and studying the Torah or the scriptures, and you would do that in the synagogue. You could do it with the singing of songs. I mean, those things were a vibrant part of Jewish worship life. But you also would go to Jerusalem to make sacrifices. And making sacrifices could be bringing, like, wheat and oil and offering it up to God. But it more often than not also entailed the killing of an animal, the killing of a bird, the killing of a goat or a baby lamb or a big old ox, right? And if you're coming from Greece Turkey, Galatia, or, you know, the area of Corinth or someplace like that, or Syria, Damascus, that's a long way to bring a goat, or it's a long way to bring the big old ox that you're going to sacrifice at the temple. So there was a system set up in the temple where you could actually just show up at the temple without an animal and then buy an animal to have it be sacrificed. And that's where this Temple of the Money Changers that's in today's gospel text comes from. And the reason why you would do this, I mean, you would kill an animal as part of your worship for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes you do it just as a way of honoring God, that the God is holy. There's something about the holiness of God, and you want to honor the holiness of God, and so you will kill an animal and shed its blood as a way of honoring the divine. And this is not unknown. I mean, you go to almost any, I mean, throughout human history, no matter what your religious practice, this way of sacrificing animals happens all the time. It's not just Judaism. It's an ancient human practice. But in Judaism, sometimes you would offer out of thanksgiving. This is the story of Cain and Abel. They raise their crops and just out of thanksgiving for the goodness of God, you offer your first fruits. I mean, Abel offered the first fruits of his lambs. He sacrificed lambs to God out of thanksgiving. Or Cain offered up wheat and oil, and God somehow liked Abel's more than Cain's. But that's the do it out of thanksgiving. Sometimes do it out of a sense of wanting to purify yourself. or purify a place. There's a sense that you feel like, hey, I feel guilty about things I've done, or I haven't really loved the way I should love, or I haven't really done the best at what I want to do, and I want to be clean and be purified by God. And so you would go and you would kill an animal again and shed its blood to offer. And even there are troughs in the temple for all the blood that gets spilled, and then this stuff goes up. Like, it's a different world than we live in, right? We don't do this anymore. But this is very present in the minds of Jesus and the first hearers of these gospel texts. And so you have somebody who's traveling from somewhere else to go to Jerusalem to make sacrifice, and they're passing by crosses with humans on them where there is suffering and there is pain and there is fear. And then you're also going to go to the temple to kill an animal to offer a praise to God. This is the world of the first century. And it's beyond our experience. I don't know what to make of that. And it's in this context where Jesus shows up in the temple in today's reading in John. And this story about Jesus overturning the money changers appears in all four Gospels, but in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it happens at the end of Jesus' ministry. It happens right after Palm Sunday, or even on Palm Sunday. Jesus enters in, and he goes right to the temple, and he overturns the money changers, and he seems to beat the money changers out with a whip, and, you know, and he says, you know, you made the house of the Lord a den of robbers, get out, and this upsets the religious authorities, and it's part of what leads to his crucifixion. That's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In the book of John, this story happens at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. He is just starting out. He's just turned water into wine in Cana, and then he goes to Jerusalem, and he steps into the Jerusalem, and he takes a whip, but he doesn't beat the money changers with a whip. He drives out the cattle. He drives out the sheep. He's using the whip to send the animals out of the temple. And then he overturns the tables of the money changers. And there's still a sense of the zeal of the house will consume me, but Jesus is actually almost seems to be doing away. It says doing away with, it's like he stopped the temple worship in process. Like, you need to have these animals in order to do what you do at the temple. And so when Jesus drives the animals out of the temple, he's basically saying, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to play this game anymore. We're not going to do this sacrificial stuff anymore. And he says, destroy this temple, and I will raise it up again in 3 days. And people are like, what? Like, what does that mean? And you have to have some sense of the temple. If you've ever seen the temple, Herod had been working to revise the temple for about 46 years. And Herod was a master builder in the ancient world. He designed these buildings, Masada. He's the one that created Masada. And he, in his renovation of the temple, the foundations of the temple are these huge granite blocks that are bigger than this piano. Each block is bigger than this piano. And he's placing them there. And so if you've ever seen pictures of Jews at the Wailing Wall, and it's often when they go, they'll pray like this at the Wailing Wall, and they'll stick messages in the cracks in the rocks. Where they're at is at the foundation of Herod's temple. It's the only thing that exists from Herod's temple, because Herod's temple was destroyed in the 60s, I think 67, 72, somewhere around there, AD, before the book of John. But it was destroyed. The Romans came in and tore the temple down. And they couldn't tear the foundation. It was too much work because it had taken 46 years to build it. And so the temple was destroyed and it stood empty for hundreds of years, right, until around the 700s. In the 700s, when Islam began to spread in that area, and Islam kind of took over that area, Islam built a mosque where the temple is. Was. They built a mosque right on top of where the Holy of Holies used to be. It's the Dome of the Rock. If you ever see pictures of Jerusalem, that there's a gold dome that'll be central. That's the third holiest shrine in Islam in Jerusalem, where the temple used to be. And so the Jews are down at the base of the temple wailing because the temple's been destroyed. And they and they no longer have the temple to worship God in. And the Muslims have the Dome of the Rock, but they're afraid because because Israel is like surrounding it, and their fear is that the Jews are going to come in and tear down this mosque in order to rebuild the temple. And that's part of the tension in Israel right now between Jews and Muslims. It's around this holy site and this holy shrine, and it's about how do we worship God and who is God. And so Jesus comes in to the temple in today's story, and he drives the animals out of the temple. And he says, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. And the Judeans are like, it has taken us 46 years to build this temple. What are you talking about? And it's after his death that the disciples remember that he was talking about the temple of his body. And in the book of John, Jesus' body is the Word made flesh. In the book of John, this is the glory of God that has come to dwell among us. And the irony, the foolishness of the cross, is that this Word made flesh hangs on a cross. That this Word made flesh, that the temple of God all of a sudden becomes a cross. And this place of suffering and torment and death and shame becomes a place where God enters in order to take it and renew it and make new life, to end sacrifice, to end the sense that somehow something has to die so that we can live. And the notion that somehow God was in the midst of this, that somehow God is doing this, that's what was foolishness to the Greeks and just scandalous to the Jews. They were like, no. And Paul's like, the wisdom of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. And there's something about the strength of God hanging on a cross, which has become kind of the inspiration for our faith. For Christianity. It's become the inspiration for this sense that somehow no death can be turned into life. That our suffering and pain, God is not absent in the midst of our suffering. God is not absent in the midst of our pain. God is not absent in the midst of our fear. That actually God is with us and dwells among us. And is there working towards our own life and freedom and transformation. And this somehow is the foolishness of God. Amen.